Bodies on the stairs with the tar of the hand, and the steps were slick with blood. Sansa dried her own tears as she struggled to comfort her friend. They went to sleep in the same bed, cradled in each other's arms like sisters. The second day was even worse. The room where Sansa had been confined was at the top of the highest tower of Maegor's Holdfast. From its window, she could see the heavy iron portcullis in the gatehouse was down, and the drawbridge drawn up over the deep, dry moat that separated the keep within a keep from the larger castle that surrounded it. Lannister guardsmen prowled the walls with spears and crossbows to hand. The fighting was over, and the silence of the grave had settled over the Red Keep. The only sounds were Jane Poole's endless whimpers and sobs. They were fed hard cheese and fresh-baked bread and milk to break their fast, roast chicken and greens at midday, and a late supper of beef and barley stew. But the servants who brought the meals would not answer Sansa's questions. That evening, some women brought her clothes from the Tower of the Hand, and some of Jane's things as well. But they seemed nearly as frightened as Jane, and when she tried to talk to them, they fled from her as if she had the Grey Plague. The guards outside the door still refused to let them leave the room. "Please, I need to speak to the Queen again," Sansa told them, as she told everyone she saw that day. "She'll want to talk to me, I know she will. Tell her I want to see her, please. If not the Queen, then Prince Joffrey, if you'd be so kind. We're to marry when we're older." At sunset on the second day, a great bell began to ring. Its voice was deep and sonorous, and the long, slow clanging filled Sansa with a sense of dread. The ringing went on, and after a while they heard other bells answering from the great sept of Baelor on Visenya's hill. The sound rumbled across the city like thunder, warning of the storm to come. "What is it?" Jane asked, covering her ears. "Why are they ringing the bells?" "The king is dead." Sansa could not say how she knew, yet she did. The slow, endless clanging filled their room, as mournful as a dirge. Had some enemy stormed the castle and murdered King Robert? Was that the meaning of the fighting they had heard? She went to sleep wondering, restless and fearful. Was her beautiful Joffrey the king now? Or had they killed him too? She was afraid for him and for her father. If only they would tell her what was happening. That night, Sansa dreamt of Joffrey on the throne, with herself seated beside him in a gown of woven gold. She had a crown on her head, and everyone she had ever known came before her to bend the knee and say their courtesies. The next morning, the morning of the third day, Sir Boris Blunt of the King's Guard came to escort her to the Queen. Sir Boris was an ugly man with a broad chest and short, bandy legs. His nose was flat, his cheeks baggy with jowls, his hair grey and brittle. Today he wore white velvet, and his snowy cloak was fastened with a lion brooch. The beast had the soft sheen of gold, and his eyes were tiny rubies. "You look very handsome and splendid this morning, Sir Boris," Sansa told him. A lady remembered her courtesies, and she was resolved to be a lady no matter what.
"And you, my lady," Sir Boris said in a flat voice. "Her Grace awaits. Come with me."
There were guards outside her door, Lannister men-at-arms in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms. Sansa made herself smile at them pleasantly and bid them a good morning as she passed. It was the first time she had been allowed outside the chamber since Sir Aerys Oakheart had led her there two mornings past. "To keep you safe, my sweet one," Queen Cersei had told her. "Joffrey would never forgive me if anything happened to his precious." Sansa had expected that Sir Boris would escort her to the royal apartments, but instead he led her out of Maegor's Holdfast. The bridge was down again. Some workmen were lowering a man on ropes into the depths of the dry moat. When Sansa peered down, she saw a body impaled on the huge iron spikes below. She averted her eyes quickly, afraid to ask, afraid to look too long, afraid he might be someone she knew. They found Queen Cersei in the council chambers, seated at the head of a long table littered with papers, candles, and blocks of sealing wax. The room was as splendid as any Sansa had ever seen. She stared in awe at the carved wooden screen and the two sphinxes that sat beside the door.
"Your Grace," Sir Boris said, when they were ushered inside by another of the King's Guard, Sir Mandon, of the curiously dead face, "I brought the girl."
Sansa had hoped Joffrey might be with her. Her prince was not there, but three of the King's councillors were. Lord Petar Baelish sat on the Queen's left hand, Grand Maester Pycelle at the end of the table, while Lord Varys hovered over them, smelling flowery. All of them were clad in black. She realized with a feeling of dread, mourning clothes. The Queen wore a high-coloured black silk gown with 100 dark red rubies sewn into her bodice, covering her from neck to bosom. They were cut in the shape of teardrops, as if the Queen were weeping blood. Cersa smiled to her, and Sansa thought it was the sweetest and saddest smile she had ever seen. "Sansa, my sweet child," she said, "I know you've been asking for me. I'm sorry that I could not send for you sooner. Matters have been very unsettled, and I've had not a moment. I trust my people have been taking good care of you?"
"Everyone has been very sweet and pleasant, Your Grace. Thank you ever so much for asking," Sansa said politely. "Only, well, no one will talk to us or tell us what's happened."
"Us?" Cersei seemed puzzled.
"We put the Stuart's girl in with her," Sir Boris said. "We did not know what else to do with her."
The Queen frowned.
"Next time you will ask," she said, her voice sharp. "The guards only know what sort of tales she's been filling Sansa's head with."
"Jane's scared," Sansa said. "She won't stop crying. I promised her I'd ask if she could see her father."
Old Grand Maester Pycelle lowered his eyes. "Her father is well, isn't he?" Sansa asked anxiously. She knew they had been fighting, but surely no one would harm a Stuart.
Vaen Poole did not even wear a sword.
Queen Cersei looked at each of the councillors in turn. "I won't have Sansa fretting needlessly. What should we do with this little friend of hers, my lords?"
Lord Petar leaned forward. "I'll find a place for her."
"Not in the city," said the Queen. "Do take me for a fool?"
The Queen ignored that. "Sir Boris, escort this girl to Lord Petar's apartments and instruct his people to keep her there until he comes for her. Tell her that Littlefinger will be taking her to see her father. That ought to calm her down. I want her gone before Sansa returns to her chamber."
"As you command, Your Grace," Sir Boris said. He bowed deeply, spun on his heel, and took his leave, his long white cloak stirring the air behind him.
Sansa was confused. I don't understand," she said. "Where is Jane's father? Why can't Sir Boris take her to him, instead of Lord Petar having to do it?" She had promised herself she would be a lady, gentle as the Queen, and as strong as her mother, the Lady Catelyn, but all of a sudden she was scared again. For a second she thought she might cry. "Where are you sending her? She hasn't done anything wrong. She's a good girl."
"She's upset you," the Queen said gently. "We can't be having that. Not another word now. Lord Baelish will see that Jane's well taken care of, I promise you."
She patted the chair beside her. "Sit down, Sansa. I want to talk to you." Sansa seated herself beside the Queen. Cersei smiled again, but that did not make her feel any less anxious. Varys was wringing his soft hands together. Grand Maester Pycelle kept his sleepy eyes on the papers in front of him, but she could feel Littlefinger staring. Something about the way the small man looked at her made Sansa feel as though she had no clothes on. Goosebumps pimpled her skin.
"Sweet Sansa," Queen Cersei said, laying a soft hand on her wrist. "Such a beautiful child. I do hope you know how much Joffrey and I love you."
"You do?" Sansa said, breathless. Littlefinger was forgotten. Her prince loved her. Nothing else mattered. The Queen smiled.
"I think of you almost as my own daughter, and I know the love you bear for Joffrey.
She gave a weary shake of her head. "I'm afraid we've had some grave news about your Lord Father. You must be brave, child." Her quiet words gave Sansa a chill. "What is it?"
"Your father is a traitor, dear," Lord Varys said.
Grand Maester Pycelle lifted his ancient head.
"With my own ears I heard Lord Eddard swear to our beloved King Robert that he would protect the young princes as if they were his own sons. And yet the moment the king was dead, he called the small council together to steal Prince Joffrey's rightful throne."
"No," Sansa blurted. "He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't." The queen picked up a letter. The paper was torn and stiff with dried blood, but the broken seal was her father's, the direwolf stamped in pale wax. "We found this on the captain of your household guard, Sansa. It is a letter to my late husband's brother, Stannis, inviting him to take the crown." "Please, your grace, there's been a mistake." Sudden panic made her dizzy and faint. "Please, send for my father. He'll tell you. He would never write such a letter. The king was his friend."
"Robert thought so," said the queen. "This betrayal would have broken his heart. The gods are kind that he did not live to see it." She sighed.
"Sansa, sweetling, you must see what a dreadful position this has left us in. You are innocent of any wrong, we all know that, and yet you are the daughter of a traitor. How can I allow you to marry my son?"
"But I love him," Sansa wailed, confused and frightened. What did they mean to do with her? What had they done to her father? It was not supposed to happen this way. She had to wed Joffrey. They were betrothed. He was promised to her. She had even dreamed about it. It wasn't fair to take him away from her on account of whatever her father might have done.
"Oh, how well I know that child," Cersei said, her voice so kind and sweet. "Why else should you have come to me and told me of your father's plan to send you away from us, if not for love?"
"It was for love," Sansa said in a rush. "Father wouldn't even give me leave to say farewell."
She was the good girl, the obedient girl, but she had felt as wicked as Arya that morning, sneaking away from Septa Mordain, defying her Lord Father. She had never done anything so willful before, and she would never have done it then if she hadn't loved Joffrey as much as she did.
"He was going to take me back to Winterfell and marry me to some hedge knight, even though it was Joff I wanted. I told him, but he wouldn't listen."
The king had been her last hope. The king could command Father to let her stay in King's Landing and marry Prince Joffrey. Sansa knew he could. But the king had always frightened her. He was loud and rough-voiced and drunk as often as not, and he would probably just have sent her back to Lord Eddard if they had even let her see him. So she went to the queen instead, and poured out her heart, and Cersei had listened and thanked her sweetly. Only then Sir Aerys had escorted her to the high room in Maegor's Holdfast and posted guards, and a few hours later the fighting had begun outside.
"Please," she finished, "you have to let me marry Joffrey. I'll be ever so good a wife to him, you'll see. I'll be a queen just like you, I promise."
Queen Cersei looked to the others. "My lords of the council, what do you say to her plea?"
"The poor child," murmured Varys, "loves her true and innocent, your grace. It would be cruel to deny it. And yet, what can we do? Her father stands condemned."
His soft hands washed each other in a gesture of helpless distress.
"A child born of traitor seed will find that betrayal comes naturally to her," said Grand Maester Pycelle. "She is a sweet thing now, but in 10 years, who can say what treason she may hatch?"
"No," Sansa said, horrified. I wouldn't betray Joffrey. I love him. I swear it, I do."
"It's so poignant," said Varys. "And yet it is truly said that blood runs truer than oaths. She reminds me of the mother, not the father," Lord Petar Baelish said quietly. "Look at her. The hair, the eyes. She is the very image of Cat at the same age."
The queen looked at her, troubled, and yet Sansa could see kindness in her clear green eyes. "Child," she said, "if I could truly believe that you are not like your father, why, nothing should please me more than to see you wed to my Geoffrey. I know he loves you with all his heart." She sighed. "And yet I fear that Lord Varys and the Grand Maester have the right of it. The blood will tell. I have only to remember how your sister set her wolf on my son. I'm not like Arya," Sansa blurted. "She has the traitor's blood, not me. I'm good. Ask Septa Mordaunt, she'll tell you. I only want to be Joffrey's loyal and loving wife." She felt the weight of Cersei's eyes as the queen studied her face. "I believe you mean it, child." She turned to face the others. "My lords, it seems to me that if the rest of her kin were to remain loyal in this terrible time, that would go a long way toward laying our fears to rest." Grand Maester Pycelle stroked his huge soft beard, his wide brow furrowed in thought.
"Lord Eddard has three sons."
"Mere boys," Lord Petard said, with a shrug. "I should be more concerned with Lady Catelyn and the Tullys." The Queen took Sansa's hand in both of hers. "Child, do you know your letters?" Sansa nodded nervously. She could read and write better than any of her brothers, although she was hopeless at sums. "I am pleased to hear that. Perhaps there's hope for you and Geoffrey still. What do you want me to do?" "You must write your lady mother and your brother, the eldest. What is his name?" "Rob," Sansa said. "The word of your lord father's treason will no doubt reach them soon. Better that it should come from you. You must tell them how Lord Eddard betrayed his king." Sansa wanted Geoffrey desperately, but she did not think that she had the courage to do as the queen was asking.
"But he never... I don't... Your Grace, I wouldn't know what to say."
The queen patted her hand. "We will tell you what to write, child. The important thing is that you urge Lady Catelyn and your brother to keep the king's peace."
"It will go hard for them if they don't," said Grand Maester Pycelle. "By the love you bear them, you must urge them to walk the path of wisdom."
"Your lady mother will no doubt fear for you dreadfully," the queen said. "You must tell her that you are well and in our care, that we are treating you gently and seeing to your every want. Bid them to come to King's Landing and pledge their fealty to Geoffrey when he takes his throne.
If they do that, why then we shall know there is no taint in your blood, and when you come into the flower of your womanhood, you shall wed the king in the great sept of Baelor before the eyes of gods and men."
Wed the king? The words made her breath come faster, yet still Sansa hesitated.
"Perhaps... if I might see my father, talk to him about
treason," Lord Varys hinted. "You disappoint me, Sansa," the queen said, with eyes gone hard as stones. "We've told you of your father's crimes. If you are truly as loyal as you say, why should you want to see him?"
I only meant..."
Sansa felt her eyes grow wet.
"He's not... please, he hasn't been... hurt or...
"Lord Eddard has not been harmed," the queen said.
"But what's to become of him?" "That is a matter for the king to decide," Grand Maester Pycelle announced ponderously.
"The king?" Sansa blinked back her tears. Geoffrey was the king now, she thought. Her gallant prince would never hurt her father, no matter what he might have done. If she went to him and pleaded for mercy, she was certain he'd listen. He had to listen. He loved her. Even the queen said so. Geoff would need to punish father. The lords would expect it, but perhaps he could send him back to Winterfell or exile him to one of the free cities across the narrow seas. It would only have to be for a few years. By then she and Geoffrey would be married, and once she was queen, she could persuade Geoff to bring father back and grant him a pardon. Only, if Mother or Rob did anything treasonous, called the banners, or refused to swear fealty or anything, it would all go wrong. Her Geoffrey was good and kind, she knew it in her heart, but a king had to be stern with rebels. She had to make them understand, she had to.
I'll
I'll write the letters, Sansa told them. With a smile as warm as the sunrise, Cersei Lannister leaned close and kissed her gently on the cheek.
I knew you would. Joffrey will be so proud when I tell him what courage and good sense you've shown here today.
In the end, she wrote four letters. To her mother, the Lady Catelyn Stark, to her brothers at Winterfell, and to her aunt and her grandfather as well. Lady Lysa Arryn of the Eyrie and Lord Hoster Tully of Riverrun. By the time she had done, her fingers were cramped and stiff and stained with ink. Varys had her father's seal. She warmed the pale white beeswax over a candle, poured it carefully, and watched as the eunuch stamped each letter with a dire wolf of House Stark. Jane Poole and all her things were gone when Sir Mandon Moore returned Sansa to the High Tower at Maegor's Holdfast. No more weeping, she thought gratefully, yet somehow it seemed colder with Jane gone, even after she'd built a fire. She pulled a chair close to the hearth, took down one of her favourite books, and lost herself in the stories of Florian and Jonquil, of Lady Shelley and the Rainbow Knight, of valiant Prince Aemon and his doomed love for his brother's queen. It was not until later that night, as she was drifting off to sleep, that Sansa realized that she had forgotten to ask about her sister.
Theon. Day stole upon them just as Stannis had, on the scene. Winterfell had been awake for hours, its battlements and towers crammed with men in wool and mail and leather, awaiting an attack that never came. By the time the sky began to lighten, the sound of drums had faded away, though war horns were heard thrice more, each time a little closer. And still the snow fell.
"The storm will end today," one of the surviving stable boys was insisting loudly. "Why, it isn't even winter."
Theon would have laughed if he had dared. He remembered tales old Nan had told them of storms that raged for 40 days and 40 nights, for a year, for 10 years. Storms that buried castles and cities and whole kingdoms under 100 feet of snow. He sat in the back of the great hall, not far from the horses, watching Abel, Rowan, and a mousy, brown-haired washerwoman called Squirrel attack slabs of stale brown bread fried in bacon grease. Theon broke his own fast with a tankard of dark ale, cloudy with yeast and thick enough to chew on. A few more tankards, and perhaps Abel's plan might not seem quite so mad. Roose Bolton entered, pale-eyed and yawning, accompanied by his plump and pregnant wife, Fat Walder. Several lords and captains had preceded him, amongst them Horsbane Umber, Aenys Frey, and Roger Risewell. Farther down the table, Wyman Manderley sat wolfing down sausages and boiled eggs, whilst old Lord Locke beside him spooned gruel into his toothless mouth. Lord Ramsay soon appeared as well, buckling on his sword belt as he made his way to the front of the hall.
"His mood is foul this morning," Theon could tell. "The drums kept him awake all night," he guessed, "or someone has displeased him."
One wrong word, an ill-considered look, an ill-timed laugh, any of them could provoke his lordship's wrath and cost a man a strip of skin.
"Please, my lord, don't look this way."
One glance would be all it would take for Ramsay to know everything.
"He'll see it written on my face. He'll know. He always knows."
Theon turned to Abel.
"This will not work."
His voice was pitched so low that even the horses could not have overheard.
"We will be caught before we leave the castle. Even if we do escape, Lord Ramsay will hunt us down, him and Ben Bones and the girls." Lord Stannis is outside the walls, and not far by the sound of it. All we need do is reach him. Abel's fingers danced across the strings of his lute. The singer's beard was brown, though his long hair had largely gone to grey.
If the bastard does come after us, he might live long enough to rue it.
Think that, Theon thought. Believe that. Tell yourself it's true. Ramsay will use your women as his prey, he told the singer. He'll hunt them down, rape them, and feed their corpses to his dogs. If they lead him a good chase, he may name his next litter of bitches after them. You, he'll flare. Him and Skinner, and Daemon Dance for me, they will make a game of it. You'll be begging them to kill you.
He clutched the singer's arm with a maimed hand.
You swore you would not let me fall into his hands again. I have your word on it.
He needed to hear it again.
Abel's word, said Squirrel, strong as oak.
Abel himself only shrugged. No matter what, my prince.
Up on the dais, Ramsay was arguing with his father. They were too far away for Theon to make out any of the words, but the fear on Fat Alder's round pink face spoke volumes. He did hear Wyman Manderley calling for more sausages, and Roger Risewell's laughter at some jape from one-armed Harwood Stout. Theon wondered if he would ever see the drowned guard's watery halls, or if his ghost would linger here at Winterfell.
Dead is dead. Better dead than reek.
If Abel's scheme went awry, Ramsay would make their dying long and hard.
He will flay me from head to heel this time, and no amount of begging will end the anguish.
No pain Theon had ever known came close to the agony that Skinner could evoke with a little flensing blade. Abel would learn that lesson soon enough. And for what?
Jane. Her name is Jane, and her eyes are the wrong colour.
A mama playing a part.
Lord Bolton knows, and Ramsay, but the rest are blind. Even this bloody bard with his sly smiles. The jape is on you, Abel. You and your murdering horse. You'll die for the wrong girl.
He had come this close to telling them the truth when Rowan had delivered him to Abel in the ruins of the burned tower. But at the last instant he had held his tongue. The singer seemed intent on making off with the daughter of Eddard Stark. If he knew that Lord Ramsay's bride was but a Stuart's whelp, well. The doors of the great hall opened with a crash. A cold wind came swirling through, and a cloud of ice crystals sparkled blue-white in the air. Through it strode Sir Hosteen Frey, caked in snow to the waist, a body in his arms. All along the benches, men put down their cups and spoons to turn and gape at the grisly spectacle. The hall grew quiet.
Another murder.
Snow slid from Sir Hosteen's cloaks as he stalked towards the high table, his steps ringing against the floor. A dozen Frey knights and men-at-arms entered behind him. One was a boy Theon knew, Big Walder, the little one, fox-faced and skinny as a stick. His chest and arms and cloak were spattered with blood. The scent of it set the horses to screaming. Dogs slid out from under the tables, sniffing. Men rose from the benches. In the torchlight, the body in Sir Hustin's arms sparkled, armoured in pink frost. The cold outside had frozen his blood.
"My brother Merritt's son,"
Hosteen Frey lowered the body to the floor before the dais.
"Butchered, like a hog, and shoved beneath a snowbank. A boy."
"Little Walder," thought Theon. "The big one."
He glanced at Rowan.
"There are six of them," he remembered. "Any of them could have done this."
But the washerwoman felt his eyes.
"This was no work of ours," she said. "Be quiet,"
Abel warned her. Lord Ramsay descended from the dais to the dead boy.
His father rose more slowly, pale-eyed, still-faced, solemn. "This was foul work." For once, Roose Bolton's voice was loud enough to carry. "Where was the body found?"
"Under that ruined keep, my lord," replied Big Walder. "The one with the old gargoyles."
The boy's gloves were caked with his cousin's blood.
"I told him not to go out alone, but he said he had to find a man who owed him silver."
"What man?" Ramsay demanded. "Give me his name. Point him out to me, boy, and I will make you a cloak of his skin."
"He never said, my lord, only that he won the coin at dice."
The fray boy hesitated.
"It was some White Harbour men who taught dice. I couldn't say which ones, but it was them."
"My lord," boomed Hustin Frey, "we know the man who did this, killed this boy and all the rest. Not by his own hand, no. He's too fat and craven to do his own killing, but by his word."
He turned to Wyman Manderley.
"Do you deny it?"
The Lord of White Harbour bit a sausage in half.
"I confess,"
he wiped the grease from his lips with his sleeve,
"I confess that I know little of this poor boy. Lord Ramsay's squire, was he not? How old was the lad?"
9, on his last name day.
"So young," said Wyman Manderley, "though mayhaps this was a blessing. Had he lived, he would have grown up to be a fray."
Sir Hustin slammed his foot into the tabletop, knocking it off its trestles, back into Lord Wyman's swollen belly. Cups and platters flew, sausages scattered everywhere, and a dozen Manderley men came cursing to their feet. Some grabbed up knives, platters, flagons, anything that might serve as a weapon. Sir Hustin Frey ripped his longsword from its scabbard and leapt towards Wyman Manderley. The Lord of White Harbour tried to jerk away, but the tabletop pinned him to his chair. The blade slashed through 3 of his 4 chins in a spray of bright red blood. Lady Walder gave a shriek and clutched at her lord husband's arm. "Stop!" Roose Bolton shouted. "Stop this madness!" His own men rushed forward as the Manderleys vaulted over the benches to get at the frays. One lunged at Sir Hustin with a dagger, but the big knight pivoted and took his arm off at the shoulder. Lord Wyman pushed to his feet, only to collapse. Old Lord Locke was shouting for a maester as Manderley flopped on the floor like a clubbed walrus in a spreading pool of blood. Around him dogs fought over sausages. It took 20 Dreadfort spearmen to part the combatants and put an end to the carnage. By that time, 6 White Harbour men and 2 frays lay dead upon the floor. A dozen more were wounded, and one of the bastard's boys, Luton, was dying noisily, crying for his mother as he tried to shove a fistful of slimy entrails back through a gaping belly wound. Lord Ramsay silenced him, yanking a spear from one of Steelshank's men and driving it down through Luton's chest. Even then, the rafters still rang with shouts and prayers and curses, the shrieks of terrified horses and the growls of Ramsay's bitches. Steelshanks Walton had to slam the butt of his spear against the floor 12 times before the hall quieted enough for Roose Bolton to be heard. "I see you all want blood," the Lord of the Dreadfort said. Maester Rudray stood beside him, a raven on his arm. The bird's black plumage shone like coal oil in the torchlight.
"Wet," Theon realized. "And in his lordship's hand, a parchment. That will be wet as well. Dark wings, dark words."
"Rather than use our swords upon each other, you might try them on Lord Stannis." Lord Bolton unrolled the parchment. "His host lies not 3 days' ride from here, snowbound and starving, and I for one am tired of waiting on his pleasure. Sir Hustin, assemble your knights and men-at-arms by the main gates. As you are so eager for battle,
you shall strike our first blow. Lord Wyman, gather your White Harbour men by the east gate. They shall go forth as well." Hustin Frey's sword was red almost to the hilt. Blood spatter speckled his cheeks like freckles. He lowered his blade and said, "As my lord commands, but after I deliver you the head of Stannis Baratheon, I mean to finish hacking off Lord Lard's." Four White Harbour knights had formed a ring around Lord Wyman, as Maester Medrick laboured over him to staunch his bleeding. "First you must needs come through us, sir," said the eldest of them, a hard-faced greybeard whose blood-stained surcoat showed three silvery mermaids upon a violet field.
"Gladly, one at a time, or all at once, it makes no matter."
"Enough," roared Lord Ramsay, brandishing his bloody spear. "Another threat, and I'll gut you all myself. My lord father has spoken. Save your wrath for the pretender Stannis." Roose Bolton gave an approving nod. "As he says, there will be time enough to fight each other once we are done with Stannis." He turned his head, his pale, cold eyes searching the hall, until they found the bard Abel beside Theon. "Singer," he called, "come sing us something soothing." Abel bowed.
"If it please your lordship."
Lute in hand, he sauntered to the dais, hopping nimbly over a corpse or two, and seated himself cross-legged on the high table. As he began to play, a sad, soft song that Theon Greyjoy did not recognize, Sir Hustin, Sir Aenys, and their fellow Freys turned away to lead their horses from the hall. Roan grasped Theon's arm.
"The best, it must be now."
He wrenched free of her touch.
"By day, we will be seen. The snow will hide us. Are you deaf? Bolton is sending forth his swords. We have to reach King Stannis before they do. But Abel can fend for himself," murmured Squirrel. "This is madness, hopeless, foolish, doomed."
Theon drained the last dregs of his ale and rose reluctantly to his feet.
"Find your sisters. It takes a deal of water to fill my lady's tub."
Squirrel slipped away, soft-footed as she always was. Rowan walked Theon from the hall. Since she and her sisters had found him in the Godswood, one of them had dug his every step, never letting him out of sight. They did not trust him.
"Why should they? I was reek before, and might be reek again. Reek, reek, it rhymes with sneak."
Outside, the snow still fell. The snowmen the squires had built had grown into monstrous giants, 10 feet tall and hideously misshapen. White walls rose to either side as he and Rowan made their way to the Godswood. The paths between keep and tower and hall had turned into a maze of icy trenches, shoveled out early to keep them clear. It was easier to get lost in that frozen labyrinth, but Theon Greyjoy knew every twist and turning. Even the Godswood was turning white. A film of ice had formed upon the pool beneath the heart tree, and the face carved into its pale trunk had grown a moustache of little icicles. At this hour, they could not hope to have the old gods to themselves. Rowan pulled Theon away from the Northmen praying before the tree, to a secluded spot back by the barracks wall, beside a pool of warm mud that stank of rotten eggs. Even the mud was icing up about the edges, Theon saw.
"Winter is coming."
Rowan gave him a hard look.
"You have no right to mouth Lord Eddard's words, not you, not ever, after what you did. You killed a boy as well. That was not us, I told you. Words are wind. They are no better than me. We're just the same. You killed the others, why not him? Yellow Dick, stank as bad as you. A pig of a man. And Little Walder was a piglet. Killing him brought the Freys and Manderleys to dagger points. That was cunning. You—" "Not us."
Rowan grabbed him by the throat. and shoved him back against the barracks wall, her face an inch from his. "Say it again, and I will rip your lying tongue out, Kinslayer!" He smiled through his broken teeth. "You won't. You need my tongue to get you past the guards. You need my lies." Rowan spat in his face. Then she let him go and wiped her gloved hands on her legs, as if just touching him had soiled her. Theon knew he should not goad her. In her own way, this one was as dangerous as Skinner or Daemon Danceforme. But he was cold and tired. His head was pounding. He had not slept in days. "I have done terrible things. Betrayed my own, turned my cloak, ordered the death of men who trusted me. But I am no kinslayer. Stark's boys were never brothers to you. Aye, we know." That was true, but it was not what Theon had meant. "They were not my blood, but even so, I never armed them. The two we killed were just some miller's sons." Theon did not want to think about their mother. He had known the miller's wife for years, had even bedded her. "Big, heavy breasts, with wide, dark nipples, a sweet mouth, a merry laugh, joys that I will never taste again." But there was no use telling Rowan any of that. She would never believe his denials, any more than he believed hers. "There is blood on my hands, but not the blood of brothers," he said wearily, "and I've been punished." "Not enough," Rowan turned her back on him. "Foolish woman." He might well be a broken thing, but Theon still wore a dagger. It would have been a simple thing to slide it out and drive it down between her shoulder blades. That much he was still capable of, missing teeth and broken teeth and all. It might even be a kindness, a quicker, cleaner end than the one she and her sisters would face when Ramsay caught them. Reek might have done it, would have done it, in hopes it might please Lord Ramsay. These whores meant to steal Ramsay's bride. Reek could not allow that. But the old guards had known him, had called him Theon. "Ironborn, I was Ironborn, Balon Greyjoy's son, and rightful heir to Pike." The stumps of his fingers itched and twitched, but he kept his dagger in its sheath. When Squirrel returned, the other four were with her, gaunt grey-haired Myrtle, Willow Witch-Eye with her long black braid, Frenya of the thick waist and enormous breasts, Holly with her knife, clad as serving girls in layers of drab grey rough spun. They wore brown woolen cloaks lined with white rabbit fur. No swords, Theon saw. No axes, no hammers, no weapons but knives. Holly's cloak was fastened with a silver clasp, and Frenya had a girdle of hempen rope wound about her middle, from her hips to breast. It made her look even more massive than she was. Myrtle had servant's garb for Rowan. "The guards are crawling with fools," she warned them. "They mean to ride out." "Kneelers," said Willow, with a snort of contempt. "Their lordly lord spoke. They must obey." "They're going to die," chirped Holly, happily. "Them and us," said Theon. "Even if we do get past the guards, how do you mean to get Lady Arya out?" Holly smiled. "Six women go in, six come out. Who looks at serving girls? We'll dress the Stark girl up as Squirrel." Theon glanced at Squirrel. "They are almost of a size. It might work." "And how does Squirrel get out?" Squirrel answered for herself. "Out a window, and straight down to the Godswood. I was 12 the first time my brother took me raiding south of your wall. That's where I got my name. My brother said I looked like a squirrel running up a tree. I've done that wall 6 times since, over and back again. I think I can climb down some stone tower." "Happy, Turncloak?" Rowan asked. "Let's be about it." Winterfell's cavernous kitchen occupied a building all its own, set well apart from the castle's main halls and keeps in case of fire. Inside, the smells changed hour by hour. An ever-changing perfume of roast meats, leeks and onions, fresh-baked bread. Roose Bolton had posted guards at the kitchen door. With so many mouths to feed, every scrap of food was precious. Even the cooks and potboys were watched constantly. But the guards knew Reek. They liked to taunt him when he came to fetch hot water for Lady Arya's bath. None of them dared go further than that, though. Reek was known to be Lord Ramsay's pet. "The Prince of Stink is come for some hot water," one guard announced when Theon and his serving girls appeared before him. He pushed the door open for them. "Quick now, before all that sweet warm air escapes." Within, Theon grabbed a passing potboy by the arm. "Hot water for my lady, boy," he commanded. "Six pails full, and see that it's good and hot. Lord Ramsay wants her pink and clean."
"Aye, my lord," the boy said. "At once, my lord."
"At once" took longer than Theon would have liked. None of the big kettles was clean, so the potboy had to scrub one out before filling it with water. Then it seemed to take forever to come to a rolling boil, and twice forever to fill six wooden pails. All the while, Abel's women waited, their faces shadowed by their cowls. They are doing it all wrong. Real serving girls were always teasing the potboys, flirting with the cooks, wheedling a taste of this, a bite of that. Rowan and her scheming sisters did not want to attract notice. But their sullen silence soon had the guards giving them queer looks.
"Where's Maisie and Jez and t'other girls?" one asked Theon. "The usual ones."
"Lady Arya was displeased with them," he lied. "Her water was cold before it reached the tub last time." The hot water filled the air with clouds of steam, melting the snowflakes as they came drifting down. Back through the maze of ice-walled trenches went the procession. With every slushing step, the water cooled. The passages were clogged with troops, armoured knights in woolen surcoats and fur cloaks, men-at-arms with spears across their shoulders, archers carrying unstrung bows and sheaves of arrows, free riders, grooms leading war horses. The Freymen wore the badge of the Two Towers. Those from White Harbour displayed merman and trident. They shouldered through the storm in opposite directions and eyed each other warily as they passed. But no swords were drawn. Not here. It may be different out there in the woods. Half a dozen seasoned Dreadfort men guarded the doors of the great keep.
"Another bloody bath,"
said the sergeant when he saw the pails of steaming water. He had his hands tucked up into his armpits against the cold.
"She had a bath last night. How dirty can one woman get in her own bed?"
"Dirtier than you know, when you share that bed with Ramsay," Theon thought, remembering the wedding night and the things that he and Jane had been made to do.
"Lord Ramsay's command." "Get in there, then, before the water freezes," the sergeant said.
Two of the guards pushed open the double doors. The entryway was nigh as cold as the air outside. Holly kicked snow from her boots and lowered the hood of her cloak.
"I thought that would be harder."
Her breath frosted the air.
"There are more guards upstairs at my lord's bedchamber," Theon warned her. "Ramsay's men."
He dare not call them the bastard's boys, not here. You never knew who might be listening.
"Keep your heads down and your hoods up." "Do as he says, Holly," Rowan said. "There's some will know your face. We don't need that trouble."
Theon led the way up the stairs. "I have climbed these steps 1,000 times before." As a boy, he would run up. Descending, he would take the steps 3 at a time, leaping. Once he leapt right into old Nan and knocked her to the floor. That earned him the worst thrashing he ever had at Winterfell. Though it was almost tender,
compared to the beatings his brothers used to give him back on Pike. He and Rob had fought many a heroic battle on these steps, slashing at one another with wooden swords. Good training, that. It brought home how hard it was to fight your way up a spiral stair against determined opposition. Sir Roderick liked to say that one good man could hold 100 fighting down. That was long ago, though. They were all dead now. Jory, old Sir Roderick, Lord Eddard, Harwin and Holland, Kane and Desmond and Fat Tom, Alan with his dreams of knighthood, Micken, who had given him his first real sword, even old Nan, like as not, and Rob, who had been more a brother to Theon than any son born of Balin Greyjoy's loins, murdered at a red wedding, butchered by the Freys. I should have been with him. Where was I? I should have died with him. Theon stopped so suddenly that Willow almost ploughed into his back. The door to Ramsay's bedchamber was before him, and guarding it were two of the bastard's boys, Sir Alan and Grunt. The old guards must wish us well. Grunt had no tongue, and Sir Alan had no wits, Lord Ramsay liked to say. One was brutal, the other mean, but both had spent most of their lives in service at the Dreadfort. They did as they were told. "I have hot water for the Lady Arya," Theon told them. "Try a wash yourself, Reek," said Sir Alan. "You smell like horse piss." Grunt grunted in agreement, or perhaps that noise was meant to be a laugh. But Alan unlocked the door to the bedchamber, and Theon waved the women through. No day had dawned inside this room. Shadows covered all. One last log crackled feebly amongst the dying embers in the hearth, and a candle flickered on the table beside a rumpled, empty bed. "The girl is gone," Theon thought. "She has thrown herself out a window in despair." But the windows here were shuttered against the storm, sealed up by crusts of blown snow and frost. "Where is she?" Holly asked. Her sisters emptied their pails into the big round wooden tub. Frenya shut the chamber door and put her back against it. "Where is she?" Holly said again. Outside a horn was blowing. "A trumpet, the Freys, assembling for battle." Theon could feel an itching in his missing fingers. Then he saw her. She was huddled in the darkest corner of the bedchamber, on the floor, curled up in a ball beneath a pile of wolf skins. Theon might never have spotted her but for the way she trembled. Jane had pulled the furs up over herself to hide. From us? Or was she expecting a lord husband? The thought that Ramsay might be coming made him want to scream. "My lady," Theon could not bring himself to call her Arya, and dare not call her Jane. "No need to hide. These are friends." The fur stirred. An eye peered out, shining with tears. Dark, too dark, a brown eye. "Theon?"
"Lady Arya," Rowan moved closer. "You must come with us, and quickly. We've come to take you to your brother."
"Brother?"
The girl's face emerged from underneath the wolfskins.
I have no brothers."
"She has forgotten who she is. She has forgotten her name."
"That's so," said Theon. "But you had brothers once. 3 of them, Rob and Bran and Rickon."
"They're dead. I have no brothers now."
"You have a half-brother," Rowan said. "Lord Crow he is."
"Jon Snow?"
"We'll take you to him, but you must come at once."
Jane pulled her wolfskins up to her chin.
"No, this is some trick. It's him. It's my lord, my sweet lord. He sent you. This is just some test to make sure that I love him. I do, I do. I love him more than anything."
A tear ran down her cheek.
Tell him, you tell him. I'll do what he wants, whatever he wants, with him or with the dog, or please. He doesn't need to cut my feet off. I won't try to run away, not ever. I'll give him sons, I swear it, I swear it.
Rowan whistled softly. God's curse the man.
I'm a good girl, Jane whimpered. They trained me.
Willow scowled. Someone stop her crying.
That guard was mute, not deaf. They're going to hear.
Get her up, Turncloak. Holly had her knife in hand. Get her up, or I will. We have to go. Get that little cunt up on her feet and shake some courage into her. And if she screams, said Rowan. We are all dead, Theon thought. I told them this was folly, but none of them would listen. Abel had doomed them. All singers were half mad. In songs, the hero always saved the maiden from the monster's castle. But life was not a song, no more than Jane was Arya Stark. Her eyes are the wrong colour. And there are no heroes here, only whores. Even so, he knelt beside her, pulled down the furs, touched her cheek. You know me. I'm Theon. You remember? I know you too. I know your name. My name? She shook her head. My name, He put a finger to her lips. We can talk about that later. You need to be quiet now. Come with us, with me. We will take you away from here, away from him. Her eyes widened. Please, she whispered. Oh, please. Theon slipped his hand through hers. The stumps of his lost fingers tingled as he drew the girl to her feet. The wolfskins fell away from her. Underneath them, she was naked, her small pale breasts covered with teeth marks. He heard one of the women suck in her breath. Rowan thrust a bundle of clothes into his hands. Get her dressed. It's cold outside. Squirrel had stripped down to her small clothes and was rooting through a carved cedar chest in search of something warmer. In the end, she settled for one of Lord Ramsay's quilted doublets and a well-worn pair of breeches that flapped about her legs like a ship's sails in a storm. With Rowan's help, Theon got Jane Poole into Squirrel's clothes. If the gods are good and the guards are blind, she may pass. Now we are going out and down the steps, Theon told the girl. Keep your head down and your hood up. Follow Holly. Don't run, don't cry, don't speak. Don't look anyone in the eye. Stay close to me, Jane said. Don't leave me. I will be right beside you, Theon promised, as Squirrel slipped into Lady Arya's bed and pulled the blanket up. Frenya pulled open the bedchamber door. You give her a good wash, Reek? Asked Sir Alum as they emerged. Grunt gave Willow's breast a squeeze as she went by. They were fortunate in his choice. If the man had touched Jane, she might have screamed. Then Holly would have opened his throat for him with a knife hidden up her sleeve. Willow simply twisted away and passed him. For a moment Theon felt almost giddy. They never looked, they never saw. We walked the girl right by them. But on the steps the fear returned. What if they met Skinner, or Daemon Dancefromme, or Steelshanks Walton, or Ramsay himself? God save me, not Ramsay, anyone but him. What use was it to smuggle the girl out of her bedchamber? They were still inside the castle, with every gate closed and barred, and the battlements thick with sentries. Like as not, the guards outside the keep would stop them. Holly and her knife would be of small use against 6 men in mail with swords and spears. But the guards outside were huddled by the doors, backs turned against the icy wind and blown snow. Even the sergeant did not spare them more than a quick glance. Theon felt a stab of pity for him and his men. Ramsay would flay them all when he learned his bride was gone. And what he would do to Grunt and Sir Alan did not bear thinking about. Not 10 yards from the door, Rowan dropped her empty pail, and her sisters did likewise. The great keep was already lost to sight behind them. The yard was a white wilderness, full of half-heard sounds that echoed strangely